had longer tapes than I do. Okay, George Perkins was a Princeton man.
And George Merck was a Harvard man. Some reason or other, they got to Princeton first. And we mentioned this morning the person at Princeton who was a physical chemist, rather eminent.
Hugh Taylor.
Mm-hmm. He recommended two people. One of them was Randolph Major, and the other was Richards, the son of Theodore Richards, who at that time was an inorganic physical chemist combination, mm-hmm. but largely inorganic chemistry. And whatever prompted them to do it, I'm not quite sure I understand, because it's hard to find any record of what transpired. Mm-hmm. But Randolph Major was an organic chemist, and he started doing his work in organic. Mm-hmm. I'm not quite sure what would happen if Richard had been hired. Mm-hmm. It could have been an entirely different company.
Yeah.
After all, Mallinckrodt never got into organics. Right. And Merck was pretty much along those same lines during that early days, you say. Mm-hmm. Mallinckrodt was a competitor of Merck, mm-hmm. as a matter of fact.
Was George Merck Jr. educated as a chemist at Harvard?
No, he wasn't. No, not educated as a chemist.
But he saw this value
saw
of
this
science.
Right. That's right.
He had vision to move in that direction.
Correct. And to the very day that he died, he had that same vision. I mean, anything he could do to help science at Merck, help research at Merck, he was a terrific guy that way. He used to go around the laboratories and talk to people in the lab. You know, he's the president of the company when it got pretty big too, even in his days. And get all excited about what people were telling. Didn't understand it, but he could see he was getting awfully excited about it.
That probably accounts for the fact that you have such a fantastic alumni.
That's right.
Merck. We'll talk about those.
Sure.
Now, you got to Merck in 1937?
1937, right.
And who were some of the other scientists there already?
Well, very few of them are still around. There's a fellow named Joe Klein, who did the work on Bill Gruey.
K-L-I-N-E?
Yeah, K-L-I-N-E.
Mm-hmm.
C-L-I-N-E. C-L-I-N-E.
He did the work on what?
B1.
Uh-huh.
With Bill Gruey, R-U-I-G-H, who was a Princeton man. I'm not sure where Klein came from. Then there was a person, John Caristesi.
C-A-R-K.
I have to write that out because that's a
okay. Put that on this one here.
Now, he was an isolation man who isolated vitamin B6, and, for example. He was a very good isolation man. He later left Merck and went to NIH and spent the rest of his life as a isolation chemist at National Institutes of Health. He worked for R.R. Williams when Williams was at Columbia as an adjunct professor. Let's see, then there's a man named Gus Stein, S-T-E-I-N, John Weilard, W-E-I-J-L-A-R-D, Swedish.
Yeah, you have a lot of papers there.
Yes, that's right. John Weilard, incidentally, I'm not sure I digress, but since you mentioned it, he was a man who only had a bachelor's degree,
mm-hmm.
but he was an excellent experimentalist.
Mm-hmm.
And he could make a reaction go, and if there was anything in it, he could isolate it. An unusually good experimentalist.
He didn't know very much chemistry, but he
was a very good experimentalist.
These were all people who were around at the time when you...
At the time I came to American Company, that's right.
Okay. So they had
Joe Stevens was there.
Okay, they had a... the research group was
yeah,
going.
I came
there. When did Major get there and then start this research group?
1930.
Okay.
Now, they say the research laboratory began in 1933, but I think the dedication of the research laboratory, this, I remember I mentioned to you we had the 50th anniversary, which would make it 1933.
Right.
And I think they took that because that's when the dedication of the new laboratories, up to that time they had facilities which were not in one building and they were spread around the factory. And I think they consider the new building where they had a real dedication as being 33 and therefore a 50th anniversary. When I came in 37, they already had about 60 people in research. This included secretaries and and helpers and so forth there. They had a budget around $300,000, something like that. It was pretty good for those days. And the business Merck was doing at that time was around $10 million already.
Okay, so was the production part of the plant nearby?
Yes, it was right in the same area, as a matter of fact.
And they only had a single production unit at that time? Or
at that time, it was one production unit, that's correct. And then,
did you, what kind of freedom did you have to make choices on what you would study in the lab? Someone like yourself coming from Harvard, for example.
Well, let me say this. The approach to the problem was entirely in the hands of the experimentalists. Mm-hmm. The problem itself, like trying to find an anesthetic, or trying to find a cardiovascular drug or something like that, that was assigned to you. But how you approach the problem,
by Dr.
what you
Major,
did in the problem.
By Randolph Major, we assigned the problem to
That's
you?
That's correct, yeah. And I can tell you exactly how we did it later on when I took over. It's an interesting way that we developed the program.
Okay.
And I'd like to tell you about
that. Yes, I'm very interested in that,
As a matter of fact, it's still being used at Merck & Company.
Okay.
You know, it's still being used on there, and they've simplified it a bit.
But your first salary was?
$250 a month.
Okay.
But you only pay $50 a month rent.
Okay.
Well, thank you.
Actually, that's not a bad salary. Really.
No, it wasn't, but I had 2 years post-op, too.
Yeah.
Joe Walker started at DuPont, or they offered me, he didn't go to DuPont, he went to the Massachusetts State Laboratory instead. But he was offered $180 a month, and we all thought, he got through 2 years before me. And everybody thought, gee, this is tremendous, and he turned it down. That was the reason thing, and we all thought, oh my God, how could he do such a thing? But he just didn't want to go to DuPont.
What was your first problem at DuPont?
At Merck, riboflavin.
That was the first assay, okay.
My first problem and excitement.
What was your first impression of the laboratory compared to the Harvard laboratory in terms of physical plant and the type of apparatus they had there?
Well, I thought it was quite good, as a matter of fact. They had everything that in those days things were very simple, and they had all the equipment, that stirring motors and LMIFS and things of that sort. In those days chemistry was really very simple, didn't require too much in the way of sophisticated equipment, pH meters, things of that sort. I guess that was the most complicated piece of equipment we had in those days. So the change into Merck wasn't that drastic as far as I was concerned. I really got excited about the concept of going to Merck. And one of the reasons that I got excited about going to Merck is that while I was still at Harvard, a publication came out of the Merck Laboratories on the structure of vitamin B1. Well, up to those days, you know, the only people in the world that knew how to do that kind of a thing were the Germans and the Swiss. And to see this paper come out with young squirts, and they were just young squirts, just kids. Joe Klein, I think, was about 30, 31. Unknown people. not the Coons and Carrer of those days.
Right.
This excited me tremendously, and more than that, someone gave a seminar on the work at Harvard. And gee, this was fabulous. I mean, this is the place I wanted to go to when it comes to an industrial job. So, you say, my reaction was very enthusiastic about going there because of the type of work they were doing. See, my recollection prior to that on work was reagent chemicals. For example, in the laboratories, things like ether, acetone, all those were Merck chemicals. I remember that because this is what we used in our research. And all I could think of at that, when I was considering Merck, was when Merck's name appeared to me, was it, gee, what am I going to do with reagent chemicals? But when it came to this B1, I really got terribly excited about the prospect of doing that kind of work. And one of the first things I did was on riboflavin B2. Randolph Major came to me and said, you know, we've made up our mind that we're going to specialize in research, in the field of research, on the vitamins. We're going to isolate every vitamin. We're going to determine the structures, if it hadn't already been done, and synthesize them and make them available. And this is a wise choice, because in those days, no one was really doing that in the States, you see. And even abroad, they weren't really commercially taking advantage of it.
There was going to be a market for it.
That's right. There was no real market. Now, Randolph Major, where he got this, whether it was completely his own idea, proposed that the day will come when we fortify flour and we fortify foodstuffs, and that there will be one-a-day type of capsules to make up for deficiencies in diets.
That was pretty far-seeing.
And I say, I don't know where he got it from, but the point is, he talked about it. And it may have been completely his own idea, but the point is that it was a field that Merck went into exclusively at those days. They were the first ones to do it. And it paid off. And I think the Merck Laboratories, with Carl Focus behind it, probably done more work on the isolation, the structure, and synthesis of the vitamins in any other laboratory in the world, for that matter.
And really, I guess, I don't know if you'd agree with me or not, but the work that was done in the 30s on the vitamins formed the basis of expertise that Merck followed up when
that's
they did the cortisone synthesis and everything
else. That's right. It set a tradition, no question about it. We're all anxious and knew how to carry out these things. And there's no question about it that this is a great learning experience and a tradition experience, no question about it. And Carl Fokers, I'm sure you're going to talk to him someday.
We want to talk to you about Carl Fokers, but then we'll talk to him too.
Sure, but he's a terrific chemist, no question about it. I'm very, very sorry when he left us.
Now, he came how much after you? He came and when?
My inclination is that he worked for Merck summers, a couple of summers. I mean, this is my memory, rather. And then he came either the same time or the year after me. It isn't clear in my mind what year he came from. I must
say. Where did he get his graduate education?
He went to Wisconsin, got his degree with Homer Atkins, actually.
Oh, yes.
He went to Illinois, did a postdoc there for a year, and then went to Yale and did a postdoc.
Getting back to Merck in the 30s, how did Louis Fieser ever get tied up with Merck?
Oh, that was in the cortisone stage.
You were doing work on vitamin K first.
Oh, that's right. You're right.
30s sometime. Let's see.
Yes. You're right. I forgot about that.
Well, wait a second. The riboflavin was essentially your first big success.
That's correct.
You synthesized via...
Randolph Major wanted me to develop a method for making riboflavin, which would be free from the work of the Swiss and the Germans. The concept was, and they were right, there were patents issuing abroad in Germany on the synthesis of riboflavin by Kuhn and also by Carrer. And he knew that he went to both people. Kuhn was tied in with IG Fabenbecker, whereas Carrer was tied into Hoffman Roach. And Randolph went to both companies and asked them if they can license, American license there. And they said the answer was no. Despite the fact that they didn't go into manufacturing, they knew there was something to it and they just weren't going to license it. So Randolph Major said it's got to be free from Kyra's work and got to be free from Kuhn's work. And this is what I tackled. So it was a matter of devising a synthesis would be practical, at the same time free from any possible patents that might issue. By that time I knew pretty much what they were doing, because the publications were already in existence and patents began to appear abroad, also in this country for that matter. So and also improvements in this thing. For example, the synthesis of riboflavin is carried out by both Kuhn and Kyra depended on making an orthofenamine diamine with a ribose nucleus tied in and condensed with alloxan. And the diamine was made from the corresponding azo compound. In other words, the orthoamino azo compound was reduced catalytically, and then this was reacted with alloxan. Well, I devised a method which I started off with the orthoamino azo compound in barbituric acid in a sort of an inamine type of reaction. And this worked out beautifully, which meant I didn't have to make alloxan, which you make from barbituric acid, nor did I have to reduce the azo grouping to make the orthofenamine diamine. So it was an improvement over the method that was devised by Kuhn and Kyra. I had to devise a method for making ribose. In those days, the method of making ribose consisted of extracting it from yeast nucleic acids. And I had to go ahead and make arabonic acid, which I made. There was an interesting literature preparation which I've always meant to go back to and study the extent of it. If you take glucose and alkali, dissolve it, dissolve the whole thing in solution, and you shake it with oxygen, you knock off a carbon atom, and end up with the arabonic acid, which is just taking off the aldehydic ring.
That's interesting there.
And I've always wanted to go back to that. I said someday I want to investigate that reaction, but I never did. It was an old literature preparation, and the yields are awfully good.
That's not one of those standard degradations of the sugar.
No, it's not a standard degradation. There are
standard rough degradation.
Yeah, that's right. Oil. Which is an iron peroxide type of degradation.
Right.
No, this is just air and alkali.
I see. Mm-hmm. Interesting.
And you separate those calcium air apatite, all you do is reduce it. I mean, you run this for, you measure the amount of oxygen. You used to run like in the hydrogenation equipment, except you use oxygen, you see.
Mm-hmm.
Measure the amount of oxygen, it'd stop after a certain, I forgot how much that was.
Mm-hmm.
And then you'd add calcium hydroxide, or calcium, to the, well, get rid of the, you add calcium to it, and the calcium arabinate would crystallize out. Beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
So I had to devise that. Matter of fact, when we first started out, it was even worse than that. We had to make our own orthoxylene. They weren't separating it yet from petroleum.
Right. Right. Yeah.
And we started to make it from xylene, from toluene, one of the reactions. Formaldehyde, HCl. I forgot the name of the reaction, the old standard method of putting a methyl chloride group in and reducing that. Well, fortunately, I didn't have to do that very long. That's a hell of a nasty thing. People came through with orthoxylene from petroleum fractionation. And today, of course, it's also making dicarboxylic phthalic acid, one of the ways of doing it. So this turned out to be a very good thing to start on, and I was very proud of that, the first job in an industry that I went into.
Did that eventually become a commercial process?
Oh, yes. Yeah, I built a plant on it.
Oh. I was going to ask you, Max, maybe, well, what I'm trying to say is that sometimes I picture you as just being in the research laboratory, but did you extend yourself and your expertise out from the laboratory and take the product you were working on the bench all the way to the plant?
Yes. Yeah. You hit it right on the head. I used to work awfully hard, obviously. And I used to come back at night and go into the pilot plant where we first started it. And, you know, help the operators and help the supervisors. They're very tolerant of me, and I got my points across all right there. So that I believe in that. That is, if a person wants to do it, let them do it. And that even though you sacrifice some of the basic research by taking your time out to do this kind of thing. And even in the production side, when we designed a plant, I played a very important role in design of the equipment. I don't mean design the actual equipment, but I knew damn well what I wanted on a reactor, for example, or how you filter it, and all the problems that you run into on this.
So you really did things that would be considered chemical engineering in many
That's
ways.
Correct. We worked with chemical engineers, but you know, in those days, and I still think it's largely true, chemical engineers had very little understanding or a feel for organic reactions. And I think that's still true today on that. Mm-hmm. They're better today, probably, because now you have computers and what have you that can fall back on those kind of things there. But in those days, they could talk about flows and agitation and all these various things, but whether a compound is sensitive, how to handle it, if it is very sensitive. Distilling means just blasting ahead, you know.
Yep.
And I think that I taught them a lot, and I got my points across. Every plant we built, researchers played a very vital role on the design of the plant. Mm-hmm. We used to go over the flow sheets with the engineers. They'd bring them over to our place and sit down and go over them. Mm-hmm. Tell them if we objected to this, or we don't like this, or you have to do something else here or something else like that. Mm-hmm. And at times we had a few difficulties trying to convince them, but we went out in the long run.
I see. Well, that's an interesting approach to plant design.
That's right. And one of the greatest skills I had in riboflavin is when the plant was running, the first kilogram of stuff that came out, I was there. It was a great thrill to see that come out. This was a plant in those days, that was a lot of money. We spent $5 million on the first plant. That was a lot of money in those days.
Well, courage to have one of your processes put on a line like that. Anyway, we were talking about the vitamin K problem came along, and we were going to talk about how Pfizer got into that.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Well, Pfizer, I was in on the problem, and actually I wasn't making I got in kind of late to begin with. Doise had already been in the field. And then I saw Pfizer's publication, and said, better go up and see him. He did a remarkable thing to me. He said, you greeted me with open arms, glad to see me, and so forth. But I called him beforehand and said, I'll have something ready for you when you come. He says, bring along some of your alfalfa extracts, which I did. Mm-hmm. Took the alfalfa extracts, the isolation was from alfalfa, and took it down to dryness, picked it up in alcohol, Kaizen alkali, you know what Kaizen's alkali is? It's a strong caustic in absolute alcohol.
Okay.
This forms two layers with petroleum ether. So he had the material soluble in petroleum ether, the residue in petroleum ether, and extracted with Kaizen's alkali. First, he'd shake it up with a reducing agent, sodium hydrosulfide, before he used Kaizen's alkali, sodium hydrosulfide. And he'd reduce the compound, whatever vitamin K was in there. And then extract with Claisen's alkali, which had also some sodium hydrosulfide in it, just to keep the reagent reduced, keep the reaction reduced all the time, because very sensitive to air, back oxidized.
Yes, hydroquinone.
And then he took that Claisen's extract and extracted, made it acidic with acetic acid, and extracted back into petroleum ether. Reduce that once more with sodium hydrosulfide, and he chilled that petroleum ether layer in the hydroquinone and vitamin K separator. And he separated this, he did it all in centrifuge tubes at this stage of the game. Took the solid that crystallized out, which is low melting, but used dry ice and so forth to get the temperature down low. Dissolved that up in ether and oxidized with a little bit of silver oxide. And there's your vitamin K. Did that all in about 2 hours' time in front of my eyes. I was so impressed. Here was, I was doing all kinds of chromatography, all kinds of molecular distillations. And I had a lot of fractions. And I was getting, going around pretty nicely, but it would have taken another month or two before I had probably pure stuff on there with a lot of work. And here he took this stuff in 2 hours' time, he handed it to me. Made a crystalline diacetate too out of it, dihydro vitamin K diacetate, which I took back with me. That made a great impression on me, on Louis Fiza, a terrific impression on me.
Was he paid by Merck for his consulting work?
Not at that stage.
Not in 1940.
Now, I did use him as consultant on vitamin K, and the work we did subsequent to that. We collaborated on a number of papers. But he really contributed, there's no question about it. I learned a lot working with him on this.
There was a lot of competition between, Doisy was, he was really the first. About the same year, Fieser had a paper in which he said, well, I'd done it before, something to that extent.
I thought at one time of trying to get at the basis of the whole thing. Now, the real argument was that the story goes that the paper that Doisy submitted on the structure of vitamin K, on the isolation, and he did a UV spectrum on it, and a visible spectrum, which he published. Fieser recognized, Lamb then sent that manuscript to Fieser to refereeing. It was a communication. Fieser read it, and the story goes that Fieser spotted immediately what it was. That I know, he told me that. And that instead of telling Doisy this, he went ahead and got some vitamin K by this extraction method, because he figured out what the thing might be, you see, and uses quinone techniques and not background to really tell him how to isolate this without going, Doisy didn't isolate it, he isolated it the same way I was trying to isolate it, you see. Doisy heard about the Salfieser's publication, which came out, I think, the same journal. The structure of both vitamin K, I think, by Doisy and by him were identical, and I think they were in the same journal.
The actual synthesis, Doisy had a synthesis several months earlier than Fieser, but maybe the structure determination wasn't.
I'd have to go back to the literature to be sure I'm right on that, but I have a feeling that, and Doisy was mad at the devil on that, because
I'd heard this story, and I wondered,
well, there was some truth to it. I never did ask Fieser what the background was. But how can, of course, the point is when a man referees a paper, he's got an application, I suppose, to refrain from doing something like this, even though the answer is so clear in his mind.
Right. Yeah.
And it'd take an awfully strong person to ignore that impulse.
Right.
Because he knew this field so well. He recognized right away what vitamin K was like and how to get it out and so forth. No question, he made a very valuable contribution. But Doisy would have had it.
Yes.
No question about it. Look, I arranged for us to have, oh my goodness.
Okay.